On the Empire Podcast this week, we see in the new year with joy. Or more accurately, we see in the new year with joy director David O. Russell. Plus, all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is flattered that Radiohead covered our Bond theme for Spectre. Just weren't enough beeps and bleeps to make it authentic, guys. Better luck next time. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. And welcome to the first Empire Podcast of 2016. How was your Christmas break? Did you do anything nice? Did you see any films? Did you listen to our Star Wars spoiler special, perchance? If you did, you'll know, as we do, that it wasn't Captain Nita who cameos in The Force Awakens due to his having been killed in The Empire Strikes Back. I'm blaming James Dyer for that one. Yeah, James is the Star Wars guy. And I believe what he tells me.
That's where we went wrong.
Anyway, we've got loads more podcasts to come this year, including our 200th podcast, which is going to be very exciting, very, very special, we hope. So look out for tentative plans to come around that one, which means we're going to make loads more mistakes over the next 50 or so podcasts this year. And this week, to help me make those mistakes, are two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our Geek Queen, a lady whose New Year's resolution involves staying 50 yards away from Jared Padalecki at all times. Well, it's not so much a resolution, more of a legally binding court order. It's Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And that is slander right there. That is absolute slander.
I think you'll find the slander is not a real. It's which one's written down?
That's
I should
libel.
Know this. Yeah, that's right. Well, I wrote it down, technically speaking.
Okay.
So I wrote it down and then I read it out.
So it's slander and libel.
Like to cover all the bases.
Yay.
And then, like Christmas, but not like Dr. Christmas Jones, a treat that comes just once a year. It's our West Coast editor, a man who's so dangerous he has two identities. Some know him as a Spanish secret agent, Jaime Blanco. We know him as James White.
Hello, England.
You?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Is your New Year's resolution, as West Coast editor of Empire Magazine, to move San Diego closer to LA so the commute for Comic-Con is like 5 minutes?
Yes. I do plan to move Whale Vagina much closer. In fact, I think I shall move it just down the road from my apartment so it's easier.
Can we not just have Comic-Con in your apartment? I mean, I've been in your apartment. It's boxy, but I think we could get 150,000 people in there.
I think that could work, yeah.
Like, mathematically, that would be fascinating to see.
I just have to go and live in a TARDIS, maybe. It could work.
We have a solution.
It could happen. Well, it's a pleasure to have you. That the authorities have allowed you to remain in the country long enough for you to come in and do the podcast, which you do pretty much this time every year. But, you know, what did you do over Christmas? What did you guys watch? Did you watch anything? Did you see Sherlock? What were you watching?
I did see Sherlock. I thought it was really good where it was just Sherlock and John insulting each other and maybe not so good in the other bits. I saw And Then There Were None, which is my favourite Agatha Christie novel, and I thought it was a good adaptation of that.
I have that on iPlayer. I haven't got around to watching it yet.
Okay.
But I'm very intrigued because Sam Neill's in it.
He is.
I like Agatha Christie.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it, I think, in that case.
Okay, good.
And I listened to a lot of Hamilton again.
Oh. Blanco, what did you do?
I was really up to date. I watched the film Made in Dagenham, which I believe came out in roughly 2011, 2012, because my mother had recorded it on her DVR in 2013 and hadn't watched it yet. So, you know, I'm really with
it. Up to the minute news there from
Topical.
James.
That's amazing. Is that literally the only thing you watched over Christmas?
No, I watched a few things. I watched the Doctor Who Christmas special, which was silly and fun, and then it became emotional and fun, and that was, you know, pretty good.
I thought that was the best Doctor Who Christmas special in forever.
It was pretty great. I mean, yeah.
What happened in it? Tell me.
Well, let me see. River Song showed up.
That's what happened.
River Song happened.
Yeah. River Song. Yeah. Okay. I don't know who that is.
It's his wife.
Oh, right. Who?
Alex Kingston plays River Song.
No, you should have said yes when I said who.
Okay.
That's 'cause...
I'm sorry.
Anyway, would anyone watch Making a Murderer, which is the thing that has got the internet by the cojones at the moment?
I did. That's the new Netflix documentary series. It is extraordinary. Back when I was a lawyer, I did some interning in America on death penalty cases for a defense firm in Houston, Texas.
It's always a fun conversation starter.
Yeah. And so some of it rang awfully true. and shouldn't have come as much of a surprise, and yet here we are, and it was surprising, and it is a terrific. It's basically like a TV version of Serial. I don't think it's quite as good as The Jinx, if you've had the chance to see that, which was mind blowing. It wasn't quite that impactful, but it was, I would say, better than Serial, less good than The Jinx.
Wow. Right, we have some questions. First questions of the year. And here's the first one from at Paul Webby Webb. He says, with The Hateful Eight coming out this week, could you all rank your favourite QT films in order of quality?
Ooh. Yeah. Now, is this as director, presumably?
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay.
You mean Destiny Turns on the Radio is going to be left out?
That's Leave It Out, sadly.
And can we leave out Four Rooms? Go on.
That's Leave Out Four Rooms.
And Sin City.
Yes.
Just like movies.
Guest directing stuff. Let's leave out Sin City. Let's leave out Four Rooms. Let's leave out movies he wrote but didn't direct. So True Romance and Natural Born Killers and bits of Crimson Tide.
So I'm going to say number one for me is actually still Reservoir Dogs.
That's interesting.
Number two would be Kill Bill Volume 1.
That's interesting.
Number three would probably be Pulp Fiction. Then let's say Kill Bill 2. Then Jackie Brown. Then Inglourious Basterds.
Ooh.
Then Hateful Eight. Then Django. No, that's harsh on Django. I don't like it that much.
Fair enough.
And Grindhouse like last by a really long way.
Yeah. Well, we'll go Death Proof rather than Grindhouse.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll go Death Proof as his movie. I haven't seen Hateful Eight yet. Sadly, I really want to see it. Big Quentin Tarantino fan. Yeah, when I first saw Reservoir Dogs, it blew my tiny mind, and I voraciously consumed the soundtrack and the screenplay, and went through a period, as I think lots of people did at the time, of trying to copy Tarantino quite a lot in terms of you would write stuff, but I think probably a lot of us have written stuff and really dreadful sub-Tarantino dialogue. But then a lot of films with dreadful sub-Tarantino dialogue got made around that time. But.
There was that time you cut the policeman's ear off while listening to a pop classic.
That has never been proven, okay?
No, it's true. It's true, yeah.
Chris.
One ear Bill, we call him.
We've talked about this capacity for confession. You know,
it's fine.
You
statute
need to
of limitations.
Watch, you need, it doesn't apply to murder. Or
it wasn't murder.
Well, fine then.
He had something on his ear.
I think we've just found Making a Murderer series too.
It wasn't even a coerced confession this time. Spoiler.
Oh, well, I'll happily tell you about people I've stabbed. It's all fine. It's all good. Blanco. Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, a vaguely similar list to Helen's, but I'm going with Pulp Fiction first.
Ooh,
then
why is that?
Dogs. Why? I just love the complexity of it. The way everything links together, the way the characters meet, the way the music works on it. I know Reservoir Dogs has a similar sort of idea, but I just think Pulp Fiction's use of music and dialogue all together and everything is just fantastic. I love it. Kill Bill, I'm technically treating as one big thing.
I'm going to disqualify that. I'm going to disqualify that. On the IMDb, it's two separate films. You're going to have to choose.
All right, fine. Kill Bill 1, then Inglourious Basterds, then Kill Bill 2.
Okay.
Jackie Brown, Django Untamed, and then much in the style of Constantine from Muppets Most Wanted, Spacebar, 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 Grindhouse, Death Proof.
Okay, fair enough. Poor old Death Proof. It's at the bottom. Nobody loves it. But what I'm surprised by both of you is that you've put Jackie Brown, which a lot of people who I think are just trying to be a bit hip about it, put that at the top of their QT lists.
Yeah, I think it didn't blow me away at the time, but it's one of those ones where every time I watch it, I like it more. Mm. So it's crept up the list a bit for me.
It's got amazing moments in it, Jackie Brown. It has the... can we really talk about spoilers for a film that came out in 1997? I think it was 1997. Mm. Probably. But there's a couple of murders come out of the blue, which still have the power to... shock and stun, and in one case it is played for laughs. It's quite funny. Sam Jackson is amazing in that film. There's that great shot where he kills someone in one shot, one long take. I think people will know the one I'm talking about. De Niro's fantastic in it. Bridget Fonda is great. Now please come out of retirement, Bridget Fonda. It's so good that Pam Grier, of course. I mean, it's just Robert Forster, Michael Keaton playing the same character he played in Out of Sight. You know, it's got so much going for it. The dialogue, which isn't all Tarantino, obviously, it's Elmore Leonard for the most part, is just phenomenal. So, yeah, I mean, It's amazing. But am I one of those hipsters who puts it atop my QT list? Slightly diminishing, I think, the impact of his first two movies. No, I'm not. So for me, yeah, it's Reservoir Dogs, then Pulp Fiction, which was, you know, still amazing, although it has too many longers. And I wonder if retrospectively the impact of the Harvey Keitel Direct Line adverts has diminished Pulp Fiction irrevocably. You know, it's no fault of Pulp Fiction. It's no fault of Quentin Tarantino's that those adverts exist, but they do exist. And some part of me blames that film. And I can't help but to deduct a point from it. I feel very arbitrary at the moment. I feel like Dumbledore giving out the points at the end of the year. But that's the way I feel.
I saw it for the first time, actually, this Christmas, because living where I do, they don't show it in America, probably for good reason. There probably would be some sort of riot. But my question would have to be, does it just count as parody, as homage? Would Tarantino not have to have signed off on it in some way?
I'm baffled by these efforts. If you don't know what we're talking about, because obviously some people don't live in England who listen to this podcast, there is an insurance company called Direct Line. And for the last year or so, they've been running adverts in which Harvey Keitel, the Harvey Keitel, actual Harvey Keitel, reprises his role as the wolf from Pulp Fiction, the fixer who comes in and fixes things in the Bonnie situation. And the gag is that lots of people have things have gone wrong with their house has been burgled or their car is broken down or whatever. And Winston Wolfe comes in and goes, "Hi, Winston Wolfe, I fix things." And they get terrified of him because they think he's going to have them killed. And he goes, no, you're insured through Direct Line, so I'm going to take you to a safe house while your house is repaired. Or, yeah, here's your new car. And then they drive away to the sounds of some, you know, surf rock. You know, gotta eat, I guess. But it's kind of, it does baffle me a little bit. It is a bit of a coup for them getting Harvey Keitel, but you know, it is a strange one. So anyway, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, I love Inglourious Basterds. I'm going to put that number three. I haven't seen Hateful Eight, full disclosure. I haven't seen Hateful Eight. Then Jackie Brown, then Kill Bill Volume 2 for me.
Ooh.
Kill Bill Volume 2, which I think is far superior to Kill Bill Volume 1. Although Kill Bill Volume 1 does have that amazing fight scene at the end. Kill Bill Volume 1, and then Spacebar, Four Rooms, then Spacebar, Death Proof, which again has that amazing Kurt Russell performance in it, but
did you leave out Django?
I did leave out Django. Okay.
After Kill Bill Volume 1.
Delete. Kill Bill Volume 2, Django, yeah. Kill Bill Volume 1.
Ooh.
And then,
all right,
we'll won't go through the space march shenanigans again. But that's where I am.
Fine.
With that, we'll let you know next week's show or Hateful Eight ranks in that for me. Here's another question then from Bob Coop. Because it's the first podcast of the year, and we're excited about the year, so he has asked, what's the film you're least excited about this year? I want to turn it around a little bit and throw it at you guys. I want to ask about the films you're most excited about this year, because, you know, every day is Christmas Eve at Empire. We're always excited about stuff. So what are you excited about?
Hello, my name is Helen. I'm a self-parody. And the film I'm most excited about is Captain America, Civil War.
Yeah. What's this film? Tell me.
It's a little kind of art house project. A lot of like Oscar nominees in
Hence
there.
Hence the sort of the secondary, the subtitle.
The subtitle, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which, as we all know, is the sign of an art house movie. And it's basically a story of an internecine conflict between a group of people who really love each other a lot, but they come to blows over a sort of political situation. Mm-hmm. A third party comes into the middle of it, a newcomer from a faraway land. Ooh. And further complicates matters. And I just think it'll be a really thought-provoking piece that looks at how we live today.
Oh, Phil's
if we are superheroes.
This sounds amazing. Phil's going to love it. I just hope there are no more Marvel movies this year. I mean, that stuff really just gets my goat.
Crazy, isn't it?
Ugh, Marvel. That sounds great.
Doesn't it?
Is that your number one film? Are you?
That's the one I'm most excited about, if I'm honest. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'm obviously looking forward to the likes of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I am looking forward to Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice. I mean, it's out on my birthday. That's probably a sign. And Hail Caesar is the other big one that I'm very excited about.
Wow. Okay. And do you want to tackle the least excited thing? There's nothing.
I mean, you know, there's some films that on paper are not ringing my bells. There's a Top Cat Begins, I believe.
Yeah, apparently it's a sequel/prequel to last year's really successful Top Cat film that apparently covers how Top Cat gets the gang together. So it will be basically Batman Begins, just with Top Cat.
Is it a sequel to Top... Sorry, there was a Top Cat movie?
Yes, there was a Top Cat movie. Was it last year? Was it the year before?
Might have been the year before.
Might have been the year before. Yeah.
It didn't
oh,
make
I remember
a
the
huge
spoiler
noise.
Special we did.
it didn't make a huge impact, if we're honest.
There was a reason for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
This one, of course, you know, will like Christopher Nolan's movie, finish with Top Cat killing an enemy, leaving an enemy on a speeding train to die. Spoiler alert. Sorry, Top Cat fans.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Ooh, isn't there an X-Men Apocalypse this year?
There is an X-Men Apocalypse this year.
I'm excited about that. I'm wary, obviously, of what they've done to poor Oscar Isaac's lovely hair. But apart from that, you know, it looks like it.
What about what they've done to his lovely face?
Oh, it's upsetting. Let's not talk about that. But hasn't it been funny watching everybody who'd failed to watch Inside Llewyn Davis go nuts for Oscar Isaac this Christmas? All these people suddenly going, who is this? Why do I not know more about him?
It's like, get on the train, people.
Get on the bandwagon.
Yeah, it's not as if he's been hiding his light under a bushel.
No.
Oscar Isaac has been brilliant for a long, long time in some ropey movies, and he's often the best thing in them. Sucker Punch comes to mind.
Yeah.
But, you know, last year he was phenomenal. He was great in The Most Violent Year. He was one of the best things about The Force Awakens.
Ex Machina.
Inside Llewyn Davis was obviously a couple of years ago, but he's great in that. If you haven't checked it out, there was that Show Me a Hero, the HBO miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic in that as well. He's just great. What a great guy. Blanco, films are you most excited about this year?
Well, like with Helen and a certain other person I can mention who is sitting in this pod booth to my right, I have my obsessions. My personal obsession is the Pixar movies, a bit like our Emma. And I am most excited about Finding Dory, which is the new Pixar film. I realise people have issues with Pixar making sequels and they think they should be doing original work, which I can understand when you see things like Inside Out and even The Good Dinosaur. But I think Team Nemo did such a good job on the original. I think there's such feeling and anticipation for this one. I think it's going to be great. I hope it's great. I want it to be great. Please be great.
Ooh, and something else actually, Moana, speaking of animation, which is the new Disney animation one starring The Rock as a Polynesian sea god. And I think with songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Have I mentioned I'm a fan of Hamilton?
I don't think you have.
Really? Oh, I should have done that.
More than four or five times in an episode. Surprised none of you John Wickers have mentioned John Wick 2.
John Wick 2! It's brilliant. I did watch it with my mum over Christmas, by the way, the first one. Not obviously John Wick 2, they haven't finished that yet. And she said it was super violent, but she also laughed quite a lot, so...
Okay, yeah, I'm a raging cliche, so I'm going to say that Civil War movie you mentioned, that sounds quite good.
Yeah.
Relevant to my interests, would you say?
I mean, you know, it's a bit of a departure for you, Chris, but I feel like, you know, you could branch out that way.
Okay. I'm a big fan of hospital movies, so Marvel's Strange Doctor, I'm looking forward to that one
as well,
later in the year. But there's tons of other great stuff coming out. There's a lot of great stuff aside the issue. There's a lot of great stuff aside to 2016. I'm looking forward to, there's another Lonely Island movie which is coming out later this year. Lonely Island's the comedy troupe with Andy Samberg and Akiva Schaffer and Norma Taconi, who were so great in SNL for so many years, but also are largely responsible for Hot Rod, which is one of the funniest films of all time.
Wonderful horror.
I'm going to say that. And I didn't get challenged. This is amazing. Yes, it's one of the funniest films of all time. You should definitely watch it. Cool beans. It's great. I'm really looking forward to that. And the blockbusters, I mean, I'm looking forward to The Nice Guys, Shane Black's new movie, Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, 1970s, wisecracking, buddy comedy, ultra-violent, brilliant Shane Black dialogue. What not to love? It's also apparently is set at Christmas. Someone pointed out there's a Christmas tree in one of the trailers. So, yes. Then little things as well. The small art house movies I'm looking forward to, like Independence Day Resurgence. Which I am genuinely looking forward to.
The trailer actually kind of got me for that one. I was excited by that. It looks fun. Lots of Goldblum in the trailer. Like, if you have Goldblum in your movie, front and centre in the trailer, thanks very much.
Yeah, lots of Goldblum, which is always a good thing. I'm really intrigued, I have to say, by The Magnificent Seven.
Really?
I mean, really?
Hmm.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I can see where you're coming from. But no, I'm intrigued by it. And Ben Wheatley's Free Fire.
Yes.
Which comes out. Ben Wheatley will have two movies this year to make up for the fact he didn't have a movie out last year.
I think we should say at this point, some movies that we've seen are no longer anticipating, even though they're not out yet.
That's a good point.
So High Rise, we happen to have seen. That's why we haven't mentioned it yet. Mm-hmm. The Big Short, The Revenant.
Creed. You know, is a movie that I have been looking forward to for a long, long time. And if you've read my review in Empire, you'll know what I think about it. But yeah, it's no longer anticipated for me. For a start, it's out next week. But yeah, High Rise is great. But I'm really looking forward to Free Fire, which will be Ben Wheatley's second movie of the year, and it's a Reservoir Dogsy movie about an arms deal that goes wrong in a warehouse between a bunch of unsavory types, and it all goes to hell in a handbasket very, very quickly. And a great cast: Brie Larson, Charlton Copley, Armie Hammer, Cillian Murphy, Jack Rayner, Michael Smiley. Phenomenal. Amazing. Cast, all killing each other. It's going to be great.
We should mention Room as well. And also, there's a little sort of kind of a spy thriller out at the end of the year. It's about this small gang of daring daredoers. I've run out of words there, sure.
That's the one.
Who have to infiltrate a government organisation and steal the plans to its new weapon system, which is called a Death Star.
Death Star?
It's going under the name Rogue One, but I don't believe it has any connection to the X-Men. So that should be an interesting
that could be good.
Little film.
Going back to when you were talking about The Magnificent Seven, which of course has Chris Pratt in it, I am very excited about Passengers,
yes.
A new sci-fi film which has Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. And frankly, I think it's because the spaceship is going to be powered by their charisma alone. And I think that could be great. It's a script that's been floating around for a long time. People love it. It had a hell of a time getting made. But now you've got Pratt, you've got Lawrence, you've got Michael Sheen in it. I think that could be something to watch out for. I think it could be a little surprise.
You guys excited about the giant movies this year? So the BFG.
Yes.
A Monster Calls, which I'm hoping it would be fantastic.
I just read the book again over Christmas. What a phenomenal book. Cannot wait for that one.
I mean, there are tons and tons of movies out this year, and most of them look very good. Midnight Special, that's another one.
Definitely.
Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some.
We get Jason Bourne back in our lives.
We get a new Ghostbusters, which I'm very, very intrigued by. Paul Feig and this all-female cast, including Christina Hemsworth, I believe, joins that all-female cast. There's so many movies this year. It's so hard to choose. Hopefully, fingers crossed, it's going to be a great year.
Definitely.
Okay. Right. If you want to have your question read out on the Emperor podcast, and why wouldn't you, quite frankly, you can do so several ways. You can send us questions on Twitter, where we're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can email us podcast@empireonline.com, or you can Facebook us, where we're Empire Magazine. Okie dokie. Time now for some movie news. Some stuff happened over Christmas that we should probably talk about briefly. Radiohead did a Bond theme, which was unexpected. We were joking about it in the podcast. And that I now feel really sorry for that poor guy who bet 15 grand on Radiohead. Although, remember, it was, they don't think they actually took the bet, but he wanted to put 15 grand. He's probably now counting his lucky stars that he didn't take it. But he wanted to bet 15 grand on Radiohead doing the Bond theme. And if the bookmaker had taken that bet, he would have been down a lot of money. But yes, over Christmas Day, Tom York and Radiohead released their prospective theme for Spectre. And then within about an hour, wily people on the internet had put it over the opening titles of Spectre and fit almost perfectly. What did we think of it? Did we hear it? And is it better than Sam Smith? Yes.
I mean, I started listening to it and got a bit bored, to be honest. Yeah. I didn't particularly love the Sam Smith one either, in my defence, but, you know. I did put it on. I had it on for like 2 minutes and nothing had happened except a noise, and I got a bit bored.
There wasn't a melody.
I like a melody.
There weren't enough beeps and bleeps.
There were more than enough for me.
They were trying to be a bit more lush and orchestral.
Yeah.
And sweeping and a bit more splendor and magnificence than they have done recently, I would say. But Helen is not in the, you would choose this Sam Smith monstrosity over.
I wouldn't. I just said I wouldn't. I didn't like it either,
okay,
particularly, but it was all right. I liked it more when I heard it in the film, the Sam Smith one. Maybe I just need to see some girls writhing over the Radiohead one to really get the full effect.
Blanco.
Yeah, I listened to it. I thought it was perfectly serviceable. I think I would agree with Chris that I probably would have rather had it over the opening credits than the Sam Smith film, the Sam Smith version, which honestly I think I pretty much forget as I'm hearing it. So yeah, I think it was quite brave of them to do it, to actually put it out there. To say, hey, they asked us to do it, and we did one, and they didn't use it, and now here it is for the world. I think that's a nice idea.
It's kind of Bondy, but it's not Bondy. You can see why they didn't go for it, and obviously Sam Smith has, weirdly enough, bigger commercial appeal than Radiohead now. So you can see why they went for Sam Smith. But I kind of feel, honestly, that it's fine, it's good, but I thought both that and the Sam Smith song didn't quite push all the Bondy buttons for me. But
are you saying they should have just got Adele to come back and do another one?
Or just, you know... John Cage could have done it. A bit of silence. Just a silent credit sequence would have been interesting.
Yes, yes, an experimental Bond film with a silent credit sequence on board.
Other things happened over Christmas. The Force Awakens became the juggernaut that I think a lot of people expected it to be, but also a lot of people were surprised by. Because you know, we had a thing in Empire a month before it came out where I asked three box office prognosticators, such a thing does exist, to put their money where their mouth is, anyway, they had some money in mouths, and they all predicted what they thought The Force Awakens would make, and only one of them said $2 billion.
Really?
Yeah.
So what
only
did the others
of them,
say?
Ian Sandwell, I believe it was, said $2 billion. The other ones went under $2 billion, 1.5, you know, it'll probably make $1 billion, so it won't be seen as a failure. I don't think it's seen as a failure somehow.
It's not seen as a failure. It's currently number 4 on the all-time list, unadjusted for inflation. Don't start writing in, for God's sake. So that means it's overtaken both Avengers, Furious 7, the final Harry Potter, Frozen, Iron Man 3, which round out the top 10. It's very close to overtaking Jurassic World. We can expect it to do that in the near future.
It's certain to do that.
Then, it is mathematically certain to do that. Yep. Then it's a question of how fast it overtakes, or whether it overtakes Titanic. I think it's likely to overtake Titanic, although not certain. It depends on how it holds up, how its legs hold up in the US and in Europe, and then how big it opens in China. Remember, I think the record there at the moment is the last Transformers, which made, I think, something like $330 million in China. Mm-hmm. You know, if it makes that much or more, then
yes,
we're in for some interesting times.
China alone was responsible for me losing a bet to Nick Desemlian about Transformers 4's global box office.
Yes, it was.
China alone pushed it over the billion mark.
It did. I'm still so sorry about that, Chris. It's I think likely to overtake Titanic. I don't know that it's going to overtake Avatar. It will depend what kind of legs it shows.
But in terms of the US alone, it is now number one.
It is now number one. It has overtaken Avatar in the US.
Yes.
Yeah. Its reception in America is phenomenal. It is already after about 3 weeks, not even 3 weeks, it is the number one film of all time in the States, which is some $750 million or change, which is astonishing.
Yeah.
And it's slowing down. But not massively.
No, it was something.
I think it's nailed on for $1 billion in the States.
I think it's looking pretty likely. I mean, it was, an $8 million Monday the other week?
Yeah, I mean, if it hits $1 billion in the States, then I have to make an apology to, I don't know the guy's name, but it was a guy who, like a Wall Street analyst who wrote a piece about a month and a half ago saying it was on course to make $1 billion in the States alone. And I accused this person on Twitter of just pulling that figure out of his arse. But my apologies to the person whose name I can't remember, because he seems to be on the money, which is why he's a high-paid Wall Street analyst, and I'm in a grey room with grey people.
Oh, I'm wearing red.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I'm wearing grey.
Anyway.
Other news.
But it's exciting, and it's made 50% of its box office in the States, which for a movie this size is unusual.
That
and
will change with China, but
that
yes.
will change. But also the same box office prognosticators who said it wouldn't make $2 billion are also now saying it probably won't beat Avatar, which is phenomenal if you think about it. This is a 7-year-old movie now, Avatar, and it's still maybe going to be by some distance the number one film of all time. I can't call it, because if it starts to display legs, by this point, if it's run, and say it's like 3-4 weeks in, Avatar was still clocking in $50-60 million weekends. Mm. Can Star Wars do the same thing around the world as well? I don't know. We'll see. We'll find out.
It's, at this point, it's about how slowly it tails off, not its absolute figures. So
Yeah, and of course to Gareth Edwards, who's doing Rogue One, and Rian Johnson, who is making the next instalment of the main Star Wars thing. No pressure, guys.
it's got to be good news for them, because it gives you a bigger base, I guess, to start from. But
a Starkiller base?
A Starkiller base.
You do wonder at this point whether Hollywood is, you know, for years they've been looking at the Marvel model and trying to copy that. Now are they going to just copy the Star Wars model and just rename every film Star Wars? Yeah. You know, will you go and see Quentin Tarantino's Star Wars, The Hateful Eight? Something that's made $4 billion.
We'll get to this when we discuss Hateful Eight, but I would actually like to see Quentin work with somebody else's stuff.
Oh.
Yeah.
Little preview there of Ellen's review. Okay, so other things happened as well. Michael Bay said he's going to do Transformers 5.
Isn't this what he always does? He says, I'm not going to do the next one. And then a year later, he says, I'm going to do the next one.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. And we've spent about as much time on that as it deserves. Christopher Nolan has announced his next film, and it's exciting. It's interesting, certainly.
It's about Dunkirk.
Mm.
Yeah, which is. I mean, I feel like I've seen it in that one shot in Atonement and or Mrs. Miniver. But I am. Yeah, that is an intriguing subject for him. It's interesting to see him go sort of historical again after The Prestige.
It is.
I think it was his last really historical one, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and he has apparently the plan is for the main roles to be taken by unknown people, and then he has this is a nice list here: Mark Rylance, Kenneth Branagh, and a certain young whippersnapper called Tom Hardy, all in talks to take roles in the film as more sort of like supporting, but that cast.
So kind of a thin red line almost approach with the bigger mm-hmm. stars in the more senior positions. Interesting.
Yeah, Tom Hardy's going to be having a really great time until he realises he's been cut out, but no, he'll be fine. He won't be angry. He's never angry at anything.
He'll deliver all his lines through a gas mask. So it's
storm the beach! Storm! Retreat!
Yeah, I'm intrigued. It doesn't seem as automatically high concept to me as Interstellar or Inception. That might be a good thing.
Yeah.
And seeing whether he can mount something, because a lot of people have issues with how he does action, and you'd imagine that a Dunkirk movie, which is about the greatest withdrawal of Allied forces in history, a noble and heroic withdrawal, that in case you don't know what Dunkirk is.
Yeah, the British Expeditionary Force were basically being routed across France by the invading Nazis and were mm-hmm. basically backed up against the sea mm-hmm. and were fighting a desperate action to hold on there, while basically every ship in England, mm-hmm. most of the UK in fact, sailed across the channel repeatedly trying to rescue them, down to little pleasure craft, picking up, you know, six or seven people at a time. So, yeah, as, you know, massive defeats go, it's a pretty heroic one, I guess.
Phenomenal story. We look forward to seeing how that one pans out. Any other news?
Well, just today there was news that Disney is planning another one of their sort of live-action adaptations of their cartoons. And this is one that actually has been a live-action film already. The story goes that they are developing a live-action 101 Dalmatians spin-off, so not another 101 Dalmatians, called Cruella de Vil. So presumably this is going to be like a Maleficent-style, you know, reassessment of a woman who kills puppies for coats. And they want the intensely likable Emma Stone as Cruella.
Uh-huh.
Who takes a look at that face and says, you know what, she looks like a Cruella? Having said that, I think it's genius, genius casting. I think she'll be really, really fun. And she's only in talks, it hasn't been confirmed yet. But she's just so funny that I can see her having an absolute ball, just completely being let off the chain and being Cruella de Vil.
You're right, though. As long as though they don't try and soften the rough edges of Cruella de Vil, this evil woman whose name literally means cruel devil.
Yes.
And as you rightly say, who wants to murder puppies so she can wear a coat. I mean, that's, you know, they tried to, with Maleficent, to go, oh, she wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
And there are reasons. There are reasons.
I mean, yes, she wanted to kill a baby, but, you know, she was having a bad day. So similar, I guess, here.
Cruella's probably just going to have a bad childhood. Maybe she gets bitten by a dog when she was young. Maybe that's what spurs it. I mean, there could be any reason.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, we'll see. Kelly Marcel, who wrote Saving Mr. Banks, and 50 Shades of Grey, although we can't hold that against her because most of the bad bits came from the book, is writing the latest draft of the screenplay. So, yeah, we'll see what she comes up with. I wonder also if they'll keep the chain smoking, which is obviously now a quite controversial issue and is unlikely to be seen in a kid's film.
Maybe she'll be vaping all the way
maybe
through the film.
Maybe she will. So that's, yeah, that was a story that caught my eye just because it seems a bit odd. Also this morning, they revealed that Fast and Furious 8, woohoo, a thing that is really happening, is hoping to shoot in Cuba. Because now, you know, some of the sort of blockades, not
the
blockades, that's wrong, the trade restrictions have come
yeah,
down. So,
that's,
you know,
feasible now.
Yeah, they've done most of the rest of South and Central America. Why not?
Plus, you send The Rock down there to shake a few hands. Everyone's like, yeah, please come and shoot here. We love you all. So
exactly.
I can see that happening.
Ben Mendelsohn's in talks to play the bad guy in Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One.
Interesting.
Which is a book I haven't read, but I believe you have, Helen, having read every book in Christendom.
Do you know what? That's on my list. I haven't read it
you
yet.
I haven't read it. It's really good.
Oh, Blanco. James has, though.
I have read it. Yes, and it is magnificent. It's
That's interesting. I've heard otherwise.
Really?
I've heard otherwise.
I thought it was fantastic. It's if you don't know the story, it's basically the idea that this incredibly wealthy Steve Jobs-esque sort of game creator guy dies and leaves a load of clues behind in a massive online world, this sort of Second Life style thing, for people to find clues to basically inherit his fortune. And so we have a young man who's always sort of, he has a bad childhood, he's been living in the online world an awful lot, and he's one of the people who tries to go and sort of get this prize, and there are some dreadful government/corporate type people who try and stop him. And it sort of takes place primarily in this virtual world where you can become a sort of your own avatar, you can do all sorts of things, and there are various challenges along the way that you have to go through to try and win this big prize. And in Spielberg's hands, it could be absolutely astounding, and Mendelsohn could be fantastic as a villain.
It says he'll play an executive for an internet corporation that has designs on Oasis.
Oasis is the name of the giant virtual world. Basically, if you inherit the keys to the kingdom, essentially the keys to the virtual kingdom, which has essentially become where everything happens, commerce, it's the internet but writ much larger.
Okay, nothing to do with the Gallagher brothers then?
No.
Excellent. Should we have a guest?
Let's do it.
Our first guest of the year, David O. Russell, has been one of the finest directors in America. For a while, he burst on the scene with Spanking the Monkey, Flirting with Disaster, Three Kings. Recently, he's made films like The Fighter, and of course, his most recent movies have seen him team up with Jennifer Lawrence for Silver Linings Playbook, for which he won an Oscar, American Hustle, for which he was nominated for an Oscar, and now Joy, for which he will probably be nominated for another Oscar. That came out last week in the UK. We sent John Jr. Nugent along to speak to David O. Russell, and when he came into London just before Christmas. Enjoy this interview. It's very good.
David O. Russell, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. We're here to talk about Joy. This feels like a very American movie. There's a sort of entrepreneurial spirit to it. There's a sense of anyone can make it. Do you feel like this is your sort of take on the American dream?
To some extent, it also harkens to me back to films that I love about someone who, I'd never seen this story with a woman, so to speak. I'd seen, you know, where she creates a family business, she's the quiet one, and she becomes a fierce power, but also very benevolent. And I felt that was very cool to me.
And obviously Jennifer Lawrence is in the lead. This is your third film with Jennifer Lawrence. And I think she said recently, you and her will never, ever, ever not do movies together. That's verbatim. Have you agreed to this contract?
Well, I think whenever you hear something like that, you should knock on wood just for good luck. Because I think it's a blessing that I think we have a good kindred spirits. And I think there's, you know, we can cycle back to each other. That's a lovely thing to have with a collaborator who is willing to take risks. And I, you know, so that's a blessing, I think. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, we'll each go off and work with other people, but I think it is nice to come back and take chances together. In this case, you know, it was offered to both of us. And we said, well, gee, what do we think about this? And we examined it together. And she said, well, we'll only do it if we can do it as David and I would do it. So first we needed the blessing of the actual Joy Mangano. And she said, yes, I trust you. You're going to make it your own cinematic fable, and you're going to make it as much of it fiction as you like. And I said, wouldn't it be cool, Jen, if we started out really with a lifespan story? You begin from a little girl. You see what's in the little girl's soul. What does the emotion joy mean when you're a kid? And it's pure, and you're inventing stuff in your room. What does it mean when you have the euphoria of falling in love and you're older and you get married? What does it mean then when you get divorced and you suddenly single mother of two and you're working at an airline and behind a desk? And where's the music of your childhood? Are you able to recover that? So these are themes I've wanted to do for a long time, and to have a lot of enchantment in the movie. The specificity of the family that's got De Niro and Edgar Ramirez. I loved her speaking Spanish, and you know, so many wonderful actors taking different chances. Isabella Rossellini as the girlfriend banker of De Niro, based on truth, who makes the whole endeavor possible. If you're, you know, from a middle class family and you want to try something, you need someone to take a chance on you. And Isabella Rossellini was sort of scary, like she was in Blue Velvet, but also sort of beautiful and charming and continental and all that. Yeah.
You mentioned the real Joy Manganiello. How heavily involved was she in the making of this film? Did she contribute to the development of the script, or was she on set at all?
We did not have her on set. You know, I made a film called The Fighter, and it's very interesting when you work with people whose real lives you're dealing with in part, even if you fictionalize it. It's a very personal thing, and you don't want to hit a nerve with them, or with, you don't want to inhibit the creators. So Joy and I spoke on the phone for probably 100 hours, and I found out some of the more fascinating details of the story are real.
How much of Virginia Madsen's character is real? Because she often steals the show when she's on screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's amazing. Mm-hmm. How much of that is real, and how much is that sort of your own invention?
Well, the boilerplate of all the characters is based on what happened in Joy's family. Well, they started out with a magical childhood, as many people do, and then it started to hit rough times. And the mother was a very quieter person who sort of hid from the world, and that's true. She did watch soap operas, and I seized upon that, because I think soap operas for a filmmaker are sort of amazing, you know, especially if you're going to do them over 4 decades.
You had to shoot these soap operas yourself. What was that experience like? Because I understand you used real-life soap actors.
In America, icons of soaps. The fact that the mother was herself a gentle creature who was able to look up to fierce women in a story on television was kind of beautiful to Jennifer and I, and it was true. It was true of many people in my family and elsewhere. They can be inspired by fierce people if they can't be one themselves. And that's part of the kid's story too, when she starts out in life, that who's going to become this person who's going to lead her family and carry them with her. And so, so shooting the soap operas was sort of amazing. And then you have a dream life. And those soap actors are extraordinary. They're creatures who, they were on nighttime soaps like Dynasty and Dallas that were iconic in the 80s. They were also on the daytime soaps, Days of Our Lives, General Hospital. And Virginia Madsen transforms herself and has never looked like this creature she's playing as the mother. And she truly knew the stories in real life. She just happened to know them because she watched them a lot. And in those soaps, you feel like you've crossed into another little magical world that's part of this girl's mind, who then becomes a young woman. In those soaps, you know, I feel like great literature, whether it's Dickens or Russian literature, has their serials. They have the feeling of ghosts. There can be ghosts. There can be murders. There can be great emotional risks taken in a soap opera. So I just thought that was cool that kind of drama that you might be living in an emotional way in your home, in a soap opera is acted out in a melodramatic way, but it's very quiet inside yourself in your home. So it was like a little comic book of Joy's life that was hovering around her head.
as you say, the sort of soap operas take a big role in the first part of the film, and then QVC becomes a big part of the film as well.
Ironically, she becomes a woman in a magical, brightly lit soap opera, a television world.
Yeah.
Which is not, again, we're not talking about high-end television or high-end, but I love treating that like, I love treating regular, ordinary lives, finding the extraordinary in them. That's magical to me. That's part of why I go to the cinema. That's part of why I love movies. And I love treating these soap operas or this QVC world, not cynically, but sort of with great sincerity and beauty, because that's what it was to the people who were doing it. To them, it was their MGM, their great studio, their magic factory. Bradley Cooper's compared the movie to The Odyssey, because she gets handed off from this metal garage world of her mother to this place in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a little cable station, where Bradley Cooper is running his little cinema empire as this shopping network.
And he's almost like a conductor of an orchestra when he's sort of overseeing QVC. Do you find any parallels with your own directing style? Do you feel like a conductor?
Isabella Rossellini, whose father was the great Roberto Rossellini, a filmmaker, she said that she made that comparison. She said that she felt her father was a conductor because in Italy they would never shoot sync sound. Right. It was always silent. And then Fellini was her father's assistant.
Wow.
Which is crazy. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So Fellini and those guys would shoot all those Italian films, even the great ones, when you look at them, they're all dubbed. But so then the director could speak during the takes, and he's in it with Marcello Mastroianni, and they're creating this magic together. We have some degree of that on our sets. Of course, it's scripted carefully, and then you can change it a little bit as we're doing it. Cooper will be a filmmaker, I think. He's got great collaborative passion and vision. He's got a lot of energy, and he would be meticulous about camera angles. His mother was our unofficial consultant because she actually watched this shopping channel and had favorite spokesmodels. And I said, why, Gloria? And she explained to me that this one was the funniest one, and this one was the one that kept her up all night and she liked. So we modeled them after that.
Did you get to watch any QVC for research? Were you ever tempted by any of the sales pitches?
You know, I remember always being, when I was younger, I'd watch late at night, but I'd always bungle the ordering of it because I was not very good with that. But I do have a great toiletry kit that was designed. You know, very often you're watching one of these things, you're like, damn, that's good. And I like that they're things that are not virtual things. They're actual things that can be well made that you can use in your hands. So, I mean, Cooper had these things. His mother got him these things that he brought with him to school with him.
A man of your talents can avoid soap operas and home shopping, but would you ever consider directing television? I mean, it is a sort of golden age of television at the moment.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think if you find the right beautiful world that you can explore on a big scale, I think then it's worthwhile. I think what Scorsese's doing with Vinyl, I don't know if you know about that. You know, that's a series he's doing with Robbie Robertson about the record business. It feels like a cousin of American Hustle. It just seems really big and fun. If you find the right, I did love all the soap actors. I felt like I could have made a movie with them. It has to be the right idea that you want to explore for a long time. We'll have to see, you know, because television, I don't know how it is here in England, but it's very tricky over there to find your way in and hold your audience.
There is an amazing soundtrack on this film, as there is with all of your films. How do you approach music? Do you sort of listen to a song and then the scene forms in your mind, or does it work the other way around? Like, what's your process?
I would say it's at least 60% the former.
Okay.
Meaning I have a piece of music I've been sitting on for many years and waiting to use cinematically. And then I write to that scene. And then about 40% of the time we find it in post when we're editing. There's pieces of music in this movie that we shot to beat for beat. One of them is the Nat King Cole piece where it's this amazing rarity of him with a speaking introduction, which is like a movie itself about snow and Christmas and homes with love in them. And I just used it to shoot this moment after she's sort of had to make her bones almost by becoming a fiercer, gangster in a way. There's this piece of music that unfolds beat for beat as she's having kind of a gentle moment after her victory of recalling her childhood, looking into a toy store window, and fake snow starts to fall from a machine above the toy store. And it's just a very beautiful moment for me of what it means when you have some of the innocence of your childhood as a memory that's beautiful, yet you have sort of the toughness and the fierceness and some of the contentment of breaking through in the grown-up world. But it's a very different kind of joy than your earlier joy in your life. It has some scars on it, but she's held on to some of that magic from her childhood.
I think that's all we've got time for. But David O. Russell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Empire.
Thank you.
Well, that was David O. Russell talking to John Nugent. I hope you were in...
Chris.
Chris.
Reviews time now.
Yay.
First up... It's the eighth movie from Quentin Tarantino, if you don't count Four Rooms, and if you don't put Kill Bills into one big lump, as indeed Blanco wanted to do. Why would you do that?
Because they can be considered one, but they're part one and part two.
Oh.
Why can't you do that? There's the whole, what is it, the whole cut or something. There is a version of it that is the two of them all together.
Yes, there is.
Yes. But there's nothing wrong with that.
But then does that count as another movie on its own?
I'm not sure.
It's all a bit tricky, but the eighth movie by Quentin Tarantino, which has the word eight in the title and comes out here on January 8th, almost like they planned it, is, of course, The Hateful Eight. It was the subject of some controversy this week with Cineworld pulling out of a deal, which at the moment still seems to be happening. They still seem to have pulled out the deal to show it in this country, which is intriguing. A little bit of brinkmanship going on between cinema chains over here, which restrict the capacity of readers to see it, which is a bit of a shame. But if you can find a cinema showing The Hateful Eight, is it worth it? Now, Helen, there was one screening of this movie. To my knowledge, there was one screening of this movie because it was shot in ultra 70mm, which is a very, very rare, prestigious and expensive format to shoot movies on and also to show them in. And I believe there's only one cinema in London, which is the Odeon Leicester Square, which is equipped to show The Hateful Eight the way that Quentin Tarantino wants it to be seen.
I don't know if it's just that one, but certainly that's where I saw it at the premiere in proper 70mm. And, I mean, look, looks-wise, this film is absolutely glorious. It's kind of interesting that they chose 70mm for this because it does take place almost entirely inside. Mm. Even when it's outside, what you're mostly seeing are interior shots of the stagecoach.
I do wonder, obviously having not seen the film, but I do wonder if Quentin Tarantino, who is one of the great defenders of shooting on film, is almost doing this to now make a point.
It did occur to me, yes. And I think that, you know, there is an element where we shouldn't lose these formats. Apparently, you know, they were using lenses during shooting and they'd be saying, well, this one was used on Lawrence of Arabia, this one was used on by Hitchcock, this one was used by whoever, which is kind of mind-blowing. And there's a great link to cinema past, and honestly, this film is just replete with references and homages to great westerns and great other films, but mostly westerns of the past. Because this is his first true western. If Django was a southern, as we're told, I mean, Inglourious Basterds had
semantics.
Western elements as well, but this one is inarguably, definitely a western. Takes place after the Civil War. features a lot of characters who have messy, mucky history in the Civil War, which may or may not come into play. And it starts with a stagecoach going through this incredible snowy landscape shot with these incredible lenses. And on board are Kurt Russell's John Ruth and his prisoner, Daisy, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. I was about to say Jennifer Scott Leigh, and I'm like, no, that's wrong. Jennifer Jason Leigh. And they stop because in the middle of the road are three frozen dead bodies and Samuel L. Jackson as Marcus Warren.
Which is how most people meet Samuel L. Jackson in real life.
He'll stop traffic that way. He needs a lift to the town, these three. He is also a bounty hunter like Kurt Russell. He needs transport for these three bodies and himself to the nearest town, his horse having died. They reluctantly take him on board. It turns out that he and Ruth slightly know each other. A brilliant Tarantino-esque conversation begins between them. They then pick up another weary traveller lost on the road, a newly minted sheriff played by Walton Goggins, and proceed onwards to Minnie's Haberdashery, the obviously named setting for pretty much all that follows. Minnie's Haberdashery. It just reeks, doesn't it, of manly men and and gunfights. Mm.
And also it explains
like the OK Corral.
Explains why the movie's over 3 hours long, because if you set a movie in a haberdasher's, you're not going to run out of material.
God. You actually just said that. That's amazing. Anyway, so yeah, they meet new characters there, including those played by Michael Madsen, Bruce Dern, Tim Roth. I don't want to give you everybody's backstory, because much of the joy of the film is how these backstories kind of unfurl and unfold.
Yeah.
It's fair to say, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say, that everybody has secrets which come into play and come into the open. There is a stunning amount of bloodshed, like some real gore, even by Tarantino standards. There's a couple of bits here where you're like, whoa, that is really bloody. Whoa.
Okay.
And there's also quite a lot of Kurt Russell's Ruth just casually backhanding Daisy Domergue, just ooh, slapping her around. And the thing is that, you know, while you're kind of on her side, she isn't a nice person either. So there are no good guys
here. It's the Hateful Eight.
I'm guessing
finding a good guy in this. It's not like Reservoir Dogs, where gradually sympathetic characteristics emerged, and obviously Mr. Orange's backstory was revealed, and you began to root for people. This, I'm guessing, is not like that.
No, there are moments where you root, because I think you'd be very, very bored if you couldn't root for anyone ever. There's always somebody that you think is less awful. Sometimes you're wrong. That's the thing. Sometimes you're wrong.
Okay.
But, you know, at various points, Ruth and Warren seem like better guys than some of the rest. Madsen seems like a better guy than some of the rest at some points.
If you're in a film and Michael Madsen seems like the best person in it, then what the hell?
It's right there in the title, man. It's hateful.
It's right.
So overall, right, it looks stunning. I have no complaints about the looks. Tarantino's, the rhythms of his dialogue and the sort of chewiness of his lines, I still love. My issue with it is I don't think he's in any way developing particularly as a filmmaker. I don't think he's really pushing himself. I don't think he's changing what he does. Maybe he doesn't have to, and for his fans, obviously, he doesn't. But he's not... There is a moment here that echoes Christopher Walken's watch speech way back in Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. And you know, shouldn't you have in, you know, nearly 20 years changed somewhat and be pushing for something else? And there, that moment in particular was a real disappointment for me, because I thought that could have been a really emotional, heavy, tough moment, and he can't help but sort of try to add this kind of scatological element, which for me,
the juvenile about everything.
It's that intention to shock rather than to really deep down provoke that I think limits him for me as a filmmaker. But everything else I thought was pretty great.
That's interesting. I mean, again, full disclosure, I haven't seen the film. I'm massively excited about it. How can I not be excited about a film with this cast? Such a great cast, and I'm a huge fan of Tarantino. But you're right. I mean, I think one of the things that dismayed me most, and there's a reason why Death Proof, I think, is at the bottom of all of our lists, is that around that time when he hooked up with Robert Rodriguez for Planet Terror and Grindhouse and Death Proof, I got a little bit saddened, I'll be honest, a little bit disheartened. You know, and that here was a guy who I thought was now making movies only for himself.
Mm.
And Rodriguez is like that as well. I don't think Rodriguez has grown one iota as a filmmaker over the last 20 years, whatever it is, since he came on the scene. But I think Inglourious Basterds and Element of Django Unchained showed an evolution, showed, you know, that he was growing.
He can do better, and that's why I would almost like to see him work just once. I'm not saying he has to do all his films this way, but like, I would like to see him do a Bond movie or a Marvel movie or do something in a system that he has to work with and adapt to, because I think he would come out the other side a better filmmaker. I think sometimes if you are just writing and directing yourself, you know, it's a long time since Jackie Brown, and everything since then has just been purely his. And I would like to see him collaborate a bit. I think that might, you know, get some new ideas flowing, change some things up. Because he is a hell of a filmmaker. You know, he absolutely knows cinema inside out and backwards. Mm. I just feel like he just could... That's why I'm frustrated that I don't feel like he's innovating in his own work as much as I think he could.
But the fact is, Quentin Tarantino, amazing cast, 3 hours, 17 minutes long, with a 20-minute intermission and a new Ennio Morricone score. We gave it 4 stars.
And also elements, by the way, of John Carpenter and other, I mean, really interesting, brilliant use of other scores in here, actually,
which I'm really intrigued, because I'm not probably shouldn't give too much away, but when I first saw the trailer, and I've actually stayed away from this movie. The script was out there. The movie began in really interesting fashion. If you know the history of The Hateful Eight, it started as a script that Tarantino wrote and he gave to his cast because he chose his cast in advance, and then somehow it leaked. It leaked on the internet, and Tarantino, in a fit of understandable pique, said, well, I'm not going to make this movie anymore because now it's out there. And then he came around and he softened on it. He changed it slightly, and they had a live reading of the script in LA about 2 years ago now, yeah. I'd say, with pretty much, I think, the same cast.
More or less.
Almost, I think, yeah.
And then he fiddled with it a little bit more. So, if you know, I didn't read the original script. I don't read things when they leak online. But I've gone at this movie completely cold. I know nothing about what happens. I know nothing about the characters. But I did see the first trailer. And in the first trailer, it's in a snowy landscape. It's a group of people being paranoid in one location. And it has Kurt Russell in it. And at one point in the trailer, he says, none of these people are what they seem. And I'm just thinking to myself, hang on. Is Tarantino remaking The Thing with Kurt Russell potentially as The Thing? That would be amazing. Or if somehow John Ruth was in some way R.J. McCready's great-grandfather, that would be astonishing. But I haven't seen the film. I don't know what I think how that turns out, but four-star.
Personally, headcanon, he is definitely related to R.J. McCready.
Okay.
But that's complete headcanon. It has nothing to do with anything in the film.
Okay. I'm writing the fan fiction as we speak.
Four stars
for The Hateful Eight. Do go and see it if you can find a cinema showing it. Good luck with that. Let's talk about some movies that came out over the Christmas holidays, which people may have probably seen. The little film called Star Wars The Force Awakens. No, we've covered that. If you haven't listened to our spoiler special in which we get Captain Edith's fate horribly wrong, all the rest of it's good. It's also got Lawrence Kasdan in there talking about the film a little bit. So do check that one out. But films came out over the Christmas period. David Russell's been on the podcast this week. What can we say about Joy?
Yeah, Joy is his latest collaboration with Jennifer Lawrence. It's not completely 100% authentic, but it's based on the life of an American woman called Joy Mangiano, who was a struggling single mother with a lot of good ideas, who ended up inventing a product called the Miracle Mop, which is essentially a self-ringing mop. It's a mop. It's sort of like a plastic bit that rings the mop section out and makes life easier for people who are mopping. So David O. Russell has essentially taken this idea and built a very similar story around a woman called Joy, who has a very sort of chaotic family life. Her parents are divorced. Her father, played by Robert De Niro, is off with girlfriends, but as the film starts, he's essentially dumped back at the family home by the latest girlfriend, who simply can't put up with him, and we did a very funny little scene. And her mother is played by Virginia Madsen. She also has a stepsister, played by Elizabeth Rome, who is envious of anything that she does. She's basically just there to be snarky and come in. She's the General Hux of the film, essentially. So Joy has an ex-husband, played by Edgar Ramirez, who is sitting in the basement. He lives in the basement of the family home. She has two kids she has to look after. And it's her story of basically just trying to convince people that she has all these ideas, that she can actually contribute to the world and make some money because she's struggling and, you know, it's a difficult life. And so eventually she manages to convince the fledgling QVC, the shopping channel in the States, with an executive played by Mr. Bradley Cooper, who, of course, she, you know, appears with on screen a fair amount, and basically convinces them to give her a shot on with the Miracle Mop. And, we'll see what happens.
The rest is history.
Mm. Indeed.
So Jennifer Lawrence is 25.
She is.
And in American Hustle, she played someone who was, let's be generous here, 10 years older than Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
But she pulled it off because she has this incredible force of personality. And this is a movie about, it doesn't, you know, track through an entire life from birth to, from cradle to grave, but
there's a fair chunk of time.
Yeah.
I'd say probably about 15, 20 years, maybe, in her life. And it sort of works. I mean, Lawrence, of course, is, as ever, wonderful. She sort of pulls off the changes. It doesn't always seem like she's absolutely aging the way you might hope she does.
I was reading something yesterday that said, I don't want to see Jennifer Lawrence play a 40-year-old again until 2030. You know, and there's an element of that. Like, with these three David O. Russell collaborations, you have to wonder what age he thinks she is. Because, you know, Silver Linings Playbook, I was kind of like willing to allow it. I'm like, well, this is a character that, logically speaking, to have been married and widowed already would usually be played by someone slightly older. But isn't it interesting to show that a young woman could be, you know, damaged and hurt in this way as well by the loss of her husband? Okay, I'm with you. And then you got to American Hustle and you've got her husband, her presumably second partner, because she's got a child already when they get married, cheating on her with Amy Adams. And you're like, really? He's married to Jennifer Lawrence and, you know, with all that hair, and he's cheating on her with... I mean, Amy Adams also looked fantastic in the film.
Also, she's a terrible human being in American Hustle. You know, she's entertaining for the audience, but she's a terrible human being.
Well, so is he. I know, it's not like he deserves better here.
Well, the film's not judging him in terms of whether he's...
Maybe it should be.
But what I'm saying is that Amy Adams in the film is not necessarily a terrible human being.
So how do we know we don't see her at home?
Why? Because she's Amy Adams!
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence is
Jennifer.
Look, anyway, my point is...
Anyway, we're reviewing Joy.
Yeah. I do believe she is slightly miscast in this role, and I think you would have more pathos to it, actually,
more
if
joy.
You had a slightly more older actress. I'm going to ignore that, Chris.
No, it was a good pun.
But to be honest, this was all over the shop for me. There are almost kind of Lynchian elements, which are kind of... There's her mother is obsessed with a soap opera and just watches it 24/7 somehow. I'm not quite sure how that works. And... And there's a moment where they're all in the soap opera and it's a sort of weird dream sequence. And you're like, okay, I'm intrigued by this, but this has nothing to do with the conventional biopic that's going on the rest of the time.
Indeed.
Here.
And it seems to just disappear.
Yeah.
It's an element that's used briefly, doesn't seem to impact her life in any real meaningful way, and then it's just dropped.
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't love this at all.
It's
3 stars.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, there are good elements. There are enough good elements for it to be interesting. Mm. But I just came out thinking, what a wasted opportunity, and how interesting could it have been if it had been, you know, just better.
I feel over the last few years that David O. Russell is really craving that Oscar.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if that is, I don't know, dulling his edge. I enjoyed the film. But, you know, it's got good performances. The use of music is fine. It looks good. It doesn't always hang together, but I do wonder if he's pursuing it a little bit too much and dulling his edge.
Mm.
I don't think this is the same filmmaker who made 30 with Disaster or The Brilliant Three Kings.
No, I would. It's hard to connect the two, to be honest. Anyway, we give it 3 stars.
3 stars for Joy. And I said for the first time in 2016, which we always end the podcast, 3 stars is a recommendation. And we also give 3 stars to Daddy's Home, which is the latest comedic reteaming of Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell after The Other Guys, Adam McKay's The Other Guys, which came out in 2010. There they were buddies. In this one, they're not buddies, they're adversaries. Will Ferrell is a very, very careful stepfather. He is married to Linda Cardellini, the lovely Linda Cardellini. And then the real dad, played by Mark Wahlberg, comes in the scene and he's rock and roll. And he's got abs and he rides a bike.
Gosh.
He's dangerous and he's Mark Wahlberg.
What a guy.
And the two of them butt heads in a comedic fashion. And, you know, I thought this was a pretty much straight down the middle Will Ferrell comedy. Much, much better than Get Hard, which came out last year.
Not particularly difficult.
Not particularly difficult. This is true. Did we give Get Hard 1 star? I think we gave it 2 stars. We definitely gave it 2 stars. It's not good. These guys have chemistry to burn. They're very, very funny together. I thought it was a bit obvious. One of the things, it has some really terrible slapstick in it, and I'm a little bit annoyed with Hollywood at the moment. Some Hollywood comedies are pushing the slapstick to illogical this sounds really daft, but unrealistic levels. So for example, in Neighbours, or Bad Neighbours as is known over here, there's a moment where Seth Rogen sits in his chair and the airbag,
uh-huh,
the pranksters, those merry pranksters, have put an airbag in Seth Rogen's chair, and he sits on his chair and it propels him up into the ceiling of his office. And A, the CG is really bad, and it's the same thing. There's a moment here in Daddy's Home as well where the CG is equally terrible, and someone takes a pratfall that's really dangerous, and the CG is just awful. And but yeah, you know, there's part of me going, yeah, that would kill that person, and that just ruined the joke for me. Like, Seth Rogen's spine would have been shattered. He would never walk again after that happened. And there's a moment here with Will Ferrell as well where you're just kind of going, and I know it's daft,
yeah, yeah,
and I know it's a comedy, but there has to be rules. You establish rules in a universe. So something the Step Brothers establishes the rules of that universe pretty well. That these guys are essentially living cartoons, and they can hit each other in the head with shovels and bury each other, and beds can collapse on them, and it's all fine. But this is a more realistic movie. And then when you have, why am I spending so much time on this?
I get it.
Anyway, 3 stars. Daddy's Home. Go and see it. Funny. What next? What are we doing? What are we doing?
Did we do The Danish Girl? I think we did The Danish Girl before Christmas.
Actually, we didn't do The Danish Girl before Christmas. We didn't do The Danish Girl before Christmas. Came out on January 1st, the latest film from Tom Hooper starring Eddie Redmayne, chasing that second consecutive Oscar. Scuttlebutt is, he's not going to get it, but Alicia Vikander's in it as well. Hell's Bells.
So yeah, this is the story where Eddie Redmayne plays a person called, well, first we're introduced to him as Einar, Wengener, but he is playing, in fact, the first transsexual woman to actually undergo gender confirmation surgery. This was back in the 1920s, 1930s. And Einar, as Lily is known at the beginning of the film, is an artist in Denmark, mm-hmm. married to another artist, Gerda, who's played by Alicia Vikander. They're very much in love, mm-hmm. Crazy about each other. But she, at least, is finding trouble in her art career, really taking off. She's told, you know, your portraits are good, but you need the right model, you need the right muse to really kind of lift you up a level. And he is very successful, but he's stuck painting the same landscape over and over and over again. He can't seem to progress, he can't seem to move on. And one day, Einar puts on a dress at Gerda's request to help her finish a body bit of a painting when her sitter doesn't turn up in time. And it sort of sparks something in the heart, and it makes Einar, in inverted commas, realise that actually that's not his true identity, that's not her true identity, that he is really Lily. And so begins this kind of really slow, very painful evolution for both of them, not just for Eddie Redmayne's character, because there is no language at the time to explain what they're going through. There is no vocabulary for it in the mainstream. So, you know, people are telling Einar that he is schizophrenic. People are telling him he's basically a psychopath, that he needs to have shock therapy, that, you know, all of these really upsetting and difficult medical treatments are attempted, and none of them seem to help. And then they go to Paris to try and get away from this and move on. And Lily really begins to emerge and begins to sort of take over, and he begins to find that as a woman, she has some kind of happiness. Mm. But it's interesting because the title of the film refers to both. Really, both are the Danish girl of the title. And
Alicia Vikander as well, you mean?
Alicia Vikander, yeah. As well. And both have to go on this journey to accept Lily into their lives and to let her kind of emerge. So, I mean, it's an absolutely beautiful human story, I would say, and it's shot like a painting. It's absolutely gorgeously shot. And of course, both people are incredibly beautiful, which doesn't hurt. It's sometimes, I think it's been criticised, and I think the reason it's slowing down in the Oscar race is that it's maybe too pretty, and it feels very Oscar-y. Which you don't necessarily want to do in a year where you're up against, you know, the much less Oscar-y feeling likes of Spotlight or even Mad Max. This one is a much more traditional kind of Oscar-type movie in that it is beautiful and brilliant acting and gorgeously put together and thoughtful and, you know, just quite lush.
It's like there's a filter on Instagram called Oscar.
It is,
and
yes.
You just click the
button. You just press that. But at the same time, it has this incredible tragedy at the heart of it and just this just astonishing human journey, I think. Which I think, you know, if you don't cry at this, you're going to be, you're a harder woman than I.
Indeed. 4 stars.
Yeah.
4 stars then for The Danish Girl. And that'll wrap up our roundup of what came out over Christmas and the New Year, pretty much. Other things are out there. You can go and seek them out. And that's it, indeed,
yes,
for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We won't be joined by Blanco. He's going back.
I am.
LA.
Yes.
When?
Well, by the time this podcast comes out, I will already be back.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's time travel. Again, TARDIS, telling
How
you.
How does this work?
It's magic.
It's so crazy. Yeah. What's the first thing you're going to do when you get back?
What am I going to do when I get back? I think I will probably buy some food because I have no food and I need food to eat. Is what I'm going to do first.
I thought you were going to say something exciting, like I'm going to Disneyland.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping for. Well, I'm going. I'm hanging out with Vin Diesel. We're going around his house.
I'm going to hang out with Vin Diesel at his house, where hopefully there is food. I still need food to eat.
Well, it's a pleasure having you, Blanco, as always.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah,
it's always lovely to, you know, actually be on the Empire podcast as opposed to just listening to the Empire podcast and groaning at some of the jokes.
I don't know what you mean, but yes, don't leave it too long.
I promise.
All right. So Blanca won't be on the show next week, but we will be joined by Alejandro G. Iñárritu, the director of The Revenant. Thankfully, he will not be bringing an angry bear with him. At least, we don't think he will be, but you never know. You never know. Until then, it's goodbye from Blanco.
See you in 2017, people.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to see a film.
Yeah?
Not The Hateful Eight.
Oh.
But I am off to see Avatar. Another... Right. Roughly 10,000 times, because I made a bet with someone that Avatar would make more money than Star Wars, and I'm worried about my investment. So I'm going to go and see it 10,000 more times, so it'll make just enough money to beat Star Wars.
How much is the bet for?
£5.
Okay, we're going to go back in the office and we're going to sit down and talk about economics, Chris, okay?
I don't know. What do you mean? I did economics at A level, Helen. I got a C. So
was it home
I
economics?
I don't think you need to talk to me about. I know. No. Production possibility curves. Adam Smith. I know my stuff. All right.
Okay.
So don't woman-splain economics to me. It's all good. All right. I've got it. Right. So how much do I need to go? Anyway, I'm off to get a loan, and we'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Possibly the longest end of it.
Return on investment, Chris. Return on investment.